Welcome to All Power to the Developing, a podcast of the Eastside Institute, where social justice, human development, and community building come together. This is where you will meet activists, artists, teachers, scholars, helpers, and healers who are bringing creativity, hope, and possibility to individuals and communities all over the world. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to All Power to the Developing. This is your host, Desiree Wanden, Des for short. I hope everyone is doing good today. Today, I'm honored to have two guests from Cape Town, South Africa, Karen Hendricks and Fakmita Ling. They are among the leaders, many of them women, of Sissy Gool House, a long-abandoned hospital that was taken over by housing activists 7 years ago. And today is a vibrant, self-governing community of more than 1,000 formerly homeless people. Karen and Fakmita, welcome to All Power to Developing. How are you doing?
Good day, Jess, and good day to the listeners. Thank you for having us.
Hi. Well. Hi, everyone. Nice to be here, and thank you so much for having us here today.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for you two being here with us, zooming in all the way from South Africa. It's going to be such a great episode to learn a lot about the amazing work going on at Sissy Gool House. Before we get into Sissy Gool House and what it is, I think I want to speak a little bit about the political atmosphere that led into this type of crisis in South Africa. And I think that kind of starts a little with apartheid. So can you kind of give us a little overview of how apartheid has taken South Africa and maybe add into that, you know, your personal history as two women that were living in South Africa when this was occurring?
Yeah, so living in Cape Town, particularly if you come from a poor or working class and black background or family, has its challenges. It's got its life challenges. And we love the experience of this inequality still today. Even though in 1994, when we moved into a democracy, we had so much hope that things, that there would be equality as well as equity. But to date, that hasn't really happened. Everything is on paper. We have one of the greatest constitutions on paper, but yet, we are still living in squalor and people are still not being treated in a just and fair manner because of the class, the race, and the fact that we are not wealthy and we do not have money. So that is, it's still, those were one of the norms of apartheid where people were classed and classified because of the color of their skins and also because of the class situation. And that defines where we are right now. We are supposed to be at the crossroads. We were supposed to be crossing over in 94, but to date, we still face the same inequalities of housing injustice, hunger, poverty, and so much more. In South Africa.
Thank you. You said, Karen, you said in 1994, when you switched over to democracy, there was thought that things would change. What exactly was going on in that time period of 1994? Can you describe a little bit about how it was and what was the thought of what it would be after this time period?
So there was a hope that, and I'd like to make reference to our constitution, that in Section 26 of the Constitution, for example, the Constitution speaks about the right to housing, that everyone has the right to housing. And in Cape Town has the biggest affordability crisis, housing affordability crisis. And in Cape Town alone, or in the Western Cape, there are more than 600,000 people who are waiting for housing. And it cannot be that these were the promises that were made by a democratic government or in a new dawn or a new democracy. And 30 years later, we have not yet realized those promises.
The same, I would like to add to what Corin has just said here nowadays. You see, with the apartheid era, our families were forcefully removed from a place called District 6, which is a very prominent piece of land, very close to the mountain, to the sea, to all the privilege. I don't like to use the word privilege, but all of these were taken away from them that time when they were forcefully removed. And for me, I was born and raised in Cape Town, a suburb called Woodstock in Cape Town. And the same thing is happening to us that has happened to our parents and grandparents at the time. They were also taken from these prominent areas and spaces and thrown on the outskirts. Why? We still don't know. As Karen said, it is because we don't have six-figure bank balances. We don't have the right color skin. We are not seen as prominent figures. That is why we get treated in this manner. And up until today, where those people were removed, nothing or little development has taken place in those in part of those areas. And the place where we are, where I was born, in my children were born in, and we were raised in this Woodstock area. The same is happening here now. It's just that the word apartheid has been changed to gentrification. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing happening over and over again. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison, he came into presidency in 1994. Right. So we had hope, we had new visions, we were thinking, hey, change is going to come. 30 years down the line, what changes has come? Where we are stuck, where we were right then, 30 years back, and we are still in the struggle, especially this housing struggle. And the areas that we were born in, our government don't see us in this environment. We are not good and fit to be in this environment. And hence our struggle. And hence, this is also how we ended up in Sasigu House. That was the old Woodstock Day Hospital that we renamed to Sasigu House. I am one of 15 families that has been evicted from a road called Albert Road. And in a 3-year struggle, a court struggle, we lost our case. And I can tell you, it was a fight and a half. Then we were given options like a place called Wolverhampton, which is 45 kilometers out of the city. And this is where we stayed. This is where we were born in. And then another option was a place called Glikkiesdorp. And the third option was a place called Kempis. And if you go into detail and look at what these places look like, where they want to put us. We did our own survey. Hence us moving and taking over this space that has been empty for almost 40 years. It has not been operational. It was just standing there. So we started the Reclaim the City in 2016. 2017, we moved into the Woodstock Day Hospital. And we made it our home. We turned it into the homes of many others as time went on. We are there now going in for 7 years. And we renamed, as you said before, our home is called Sasigu House. Lots of promises there.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much for everything that you just gave there in terms of the background and the political situation, and also, you know, just the brutality that people have faced from the government.
Mm-hmm.
So you're facing this apartheid, you're facing this kind of lynching, so to speak, through legislation that is displacing many people.
Absolutely.
Where are these movements coming up from? You just said here, Fakmita, you said that you among 15 families, And then Karen, you spoke a little some. How did these movements initially get started? Did it just get started out of people in the communities coming together to band together? Or were different people from different areas coming together and unifying to form these movements that initially took on apartheid?
Yes. That is exactly what happened. You know, with our parents and grandparents, they didn't have a leg to stand on, sort of. They were just thrown in the deep end, and they just had to take what was thrown at them. Hence, them being forcefully removed from their homes at that time. But now it's with us, it's a different scenario. We are not going to take anything thrown at us just sitting down. And for me, I am a kindergarten teacher. I was not even politically bound or politically inclined to do anything until I was evicted from my home. And then all of these just sort of the thinking back and the reoccurrence of events and things like that. So that just angered me along the way. And thinking that this is what my parents had to endure and accept. But we, this generation, is not going to just sit back and take everything being thrown at us. We are not going to do that. And we didn't do that. And we started the social movement, Reclaim the City. And that is exactly what it says. We are reclaiming what is ours. We are reclaiming the city, because we have a slogan that says, yeah, the city works for us. But with us, the city does not work for us. It works for certain individuals. So with that said, our movement is based on community members of people being evicted from their homes, of people who were faced with eviction. Hence, Reclaim the City was born.
Yes. And Karen, for you, I mean, Hagmi just said that you were a kindergarten teacher, not so politically inclined, and this just woke you up. Karen, where were you in your political life, in your personal life, when a lot of this was happening?
The days I'd like to believe, and I think I came here wearing my t-shirt today, that the personal is political. And it is so, Des, because of our lived experience. And also, you know, when in Cape Town, there is a housing backlog, right? Because of housing unaffordability and because of the spatial planning, the apartheid spatial planning that still exists today. But this very housing backlog has also pushed people like ourselves towards housing self-provisioning or self-provisioning housing, because the state at all levels they actually lack the will to provide housing. And this is what we have seen over the years that we have now been occupying this building. But in the interim, while occupying the abandoned building, we have also been called all kinds of names. We've been called queue hijackers. We've been called queue jumpers, building hijackers, criminals. And the thing is, the one thing that the state has missed, the state at all levels has missed, is that we have actually transformed an abandoned building into a home for more than 1,000 residents who would otherwise have been left homeless, whose dignity has actually been taken away from them. And so that, on that basis, we are very serious about the labor that is involved in leading in these occupations, in coordinating in the occupation, in the daily challenges that we face in the occupation as leaders of the community and occupiers too. We too are occupiers. And so hence we say that the personal is political, because these are the very challenges that we live all the time. We face it, and we are faced with a state that does not want to take accountability for their own failures.
For the lack of providing people with homes, a backlog of over 345,000 karmas speak under correction, a backlog of that. And yet we are sitting here with public parcels of vacant land that is being sold off to private developers at a pittance of what the actual land is actually worth. And this is what really bugs me. And we would like to think that we are not the problem. We are the solution because we have provided these families with homes where the city failed to do that. That it is written in our constitution, chapter 3, bullet 26. Nobody is to be left homeless or displaced. No one. It is our constitutional right to have a roof over our heads. And these people have failed in all avenues, in all spheres. They have failed into doing this. So we took initiative and we created for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we stepped up. We took people from the street and we placed them in Sasi Gold House. And this now became a problem for the city, who up until today does not have a plan in place to give these people the backlog I'm talking about. Me, myself, I am on that list, awaiting almost 20 years. Wow. I mean, really now, use that public vacant land. They don't want to develop on there. They want to develop at a price, at a profit. Now, our slogan says, land for people, not for profit. Stop selling our land to private developers without meaningful engaging with us as if we do not exist. We are the people we need to be communicated to and engage with before you take your decisions, before you go and do whatever you want to do out there at a profit. See to your people, because your slogan clearly says the city works for you. The city is definitely not working for us.
Yes, yes. Sounds like they're working against you. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I would like to speak about the initiative that you guys did take. Sasi Gold House was originally the Woodstock Hospital, which was abandoned. Could you speak a little bit about that? If you know any history about that hospital, what did that hospital mean to that community, and why was it initially abandoned? If you know,
you want to go. So once again, I think Fahmida also touched on gentrification.
Okay,
and so this is the kind of state that we live in, a state that prioritizes profit over people and people's lives. And during the time when this hospital was abandoned, or this space was abandoned, it was obviously said that they could no longer afford to uphold the facility.
Wow.
But also the reason that the hospital had been, at the time, the hospital was one of the sites, the abandoned sites of public land that was promised, and it was earmarked for affordable housing or for social housing. And that too did not happen. And the only reason that this space then, the moment we went to occupy the space, it was at that time that the municipality or the city of Cape Town then earmarked the actual site for affordable housing for families. But even though they did that, they could not have done that without pressure from us. So up to the point that it was earmarked for affordable housing, we were the ones who put pressure on them.
Mm.
Reclaim the City movement put pressure on the city not to sell off the land to private developers, but rather to transform it into a housing development for poor and working class families, those who needed to access the city and the opportunities of the city.
You know, there's this Woodstock Day Hospital. was a community hospital where we as children were taken to when we were ill, when we need to have our injections, our immunizations, when we had to have an emergency. My mother was hospitalized in that very hospital more than once because she was a heart patient. So in that facility, we often frequented there when we fell ill or otherwise, and it was later developed also into like a dispensary where you could go and collect your meds from. So the one side just sort of fell away. Why, we don't know. But before we moved in there, it was already vacant for more than 14 years. So little did I to think that this hospital that I frequented as a child was going to become my home one day. That the thought never crossed my mind. And even now, if we move into certain sections, like the section where I moved in, we renamed that section Albert Road because that is the place where we were evicted from. So that space there, it just brought in, it brought back many memories because as a child, I walked those passages going to visit my mom who was hospitalized. My sister's child was born there at some time. Somebody else is living in that cubicle where her child was born in. You know, so when the memories and us living there at this point, it speaks to each other. This hospital not only is our home today, but it also is, it has memories. It brings back memories, childhood memories, and it makes it even more personal at that.
Yes, yes. I think we're going to pause really quick to take a commercial break. When we come back from the commercial break, we're going to learn a little bit more about the occupancy, the challenges of going inside of a building and making it a home. We're also going to talk a little bit about the political situation today in South Africa and where these two women are today and where their work is today. This is All Power to the Developing, and we'll be right back after this short commercial break.
Hi, I'm Melissa Meyer, Associate Director of the Eastside Institute. Welcome to All Power to the Developing. I hope you're enjoying today's conversation. In each episode, we introduce you to some amazing performance activists, play revolutionaries, and developmentalists from around the world who talk to us about their creative grassroots efforts to build a better world. If you like what you hear, please follow and share the series. You can find us on Amazon, Spotify, and Podbean. We'd love to hear your comments and ideas. Like everything at the Institute, the growth of All Power to the Developing depends upon the people who create it and benefit from it. We hope you're one of them. Thanks for your support, and now back to our conversation.
All Power to the Developing, and we are back with our two guests, Karen and Akmita. So we are now at the stage where many things have taken place. Communities have been destroyed. People have been displaced. But you guys have made the decision that we are going to occupy the former Woodstock Hospital, and we are going to turn this abandoned building into a home for people and call it Sissy Gool House. What were some of those initial challenges of, you know, because I haven't put up a drywall before. I mean, I've done some construction projects over my time. But to go into a building, now dealing with structural issues, now dealing with electrical, now dealing with preservation of food, right? Dealing with, so there's so many things to really think about, right? So I really want to go there with you. What were some of those challenges of initially going into that space and turning it into what you've turned it into?
Yeah, so the building had fallen into disrepair. I mean, when we first moved in there, the building was full with debris. With rats. The building had fallen into disrepair. It was vandalized. It was abandoned. But from the people in our community then, who moved in there, they were the ones who then started to, I'll use the word fund the repair of the building. And this was done through those residents who were artisans, who come from the poorer end of the working class, who are bricklayers, plumbers, electricians, and initially a lot of them who have done building work. They were in and amongst those families who were displaced. And that is where the repair to the building then started. And also the repair to the building then continued with a monthly contribution, maintenance contribution, where each family or each household or head of household would then pay 50 rand a contribution toward the repair to the building. And in that way, the building then was transformed from its skeleton, from its vandalized skeleton, into a home for more than 1,000 people.
When we moved in there, yeah, this was a derelict piece of building. You can just imagine, it's just a pity. We didn't take the before and after pictures. That would have given you a clear picture of what we moved into at the time. The place was full of dead birds, dead rats. The water was knee length, and the water already turned green because it was stagnated into certain parts of that building. The building was dark. Some places were cordoned off. It was barricaded with burglar doors and things, gates. And where we moved into, before the contribution structure started, we had to put our hands into our pockets and do everything ourselves. Hence, we reinstalled the electricity. We turned back on the water. We cleaned out that place for almost a month before we could actually start moving into certain areas. And I was one of the families that moved in last in the section that I manage called Albert Road. And before people were put into rooms and things like that, because now we had to navigate our way through the space here. Remember, this was an old hospital. So we have our X-ray section, we have surgery section, we have the dispensary section. So the section where I am staying was the old X-ray section, for instance. So you can just imagine every window being barred closed, because where you take your X-rays, everything has to be dark. So I literally moved into a dark space that I had to put light in and things like that. So each section of that hospital told its story. So when people moved in and conformed the space into their homes, you would never say that. We joke about it today. If you want to get to me, you go through the X-ray section. Then they will know which way to go to get to me. And another family lived where all the surgeries took place. They will just direct them to the surgery passage. You know, things like that. Today, we joke about it. But when we moved in, it was not a joke at all. It was peer pressure. It was fear. It was anger, and was all sort of emotions that was just infused with each other. Today we can sort of relax, but not relax in the sense of relaxing, because our fight is far from over. It's far from over. And even if we are 7 years in that space there, still the city is not giving up their tactics and their ways to get us out of that space. But not even they have something in plan for us other than those atrocious places that they want us to move to. And, you know, when we moved into the space, we too didn't know what the heck we are going to do here. But as we moved on, we had our meetings on a Tuesday and a Wednesday. And with this, we collected, we had a kitchen box. If you come to the, whatever you could throw in there. And then as the weeks go on, we could offer you a cup of soup when you come to a meeting. We could offer you a cup of coffee from that kitchen money that we put that box there. So things like that. And when we were really into the swing of things, we started to create structures and mandated certain comrades and they were mandated to do certain things. Hence, we ended up with a structure like our elderly structure. We had a youth structure. We had a safety task team structure. We had a maintenance, and those were all structures comprising of the people living in the space there. We made turns sitting at the gates, watching that gates, seeing that no element or unsavory character walk into those gates. And that is what we started. And up until today, we are working with that structures. And it worked for us then, and it is still working for us now. With our elderly structure, Karen and myself, we were on that structure with other monitors and leaders. And like, you know, our elderly, these were people that were thrown out by their own children, that were displaced by or put in to a shelter all on their own. We took them. We sort of let them move and took them under our wing, but they were our elders. So we took it upon ourselves and became responsible for them in some sort, if I may put it like that. So this is what the city didn't want. They didn't want to see us succeed in this manner, that we were managing the space that they left there for more than 14 years, going into derelict and just leaving that space there until they could find another buyer for that particular space. You know, when I talk about this, it just emotions flare up again, because at this government who is failing us on a daily basis, failing us and not eradicating or getting rid of this apartheid mindset of them, it is as clear as present daylight the way we are being treated. You are in a certain class. You are, you know, it's just very sad.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just very sad.
Absolutely.
I can tell you that much.
I want to speak a little bit about the emotional impact, because you spoke about the structural challenges and what it takes, but I really want to speak about the emotional challenges and what it takes. You know, you're coming out of apartheid, people are being abused, beaten, displaced, you're literally being, you know, castrated, lynched out of society. How are you guys able to just have this resilience to continue this movement throughout all of this, and then now having to deal with structural issues altogether, building all of this? How is it for everyone, you two emotionally, and then the emotional support that the community gives to each other to maintain this movement?
That is of utmost importance. I'm going to give over to Karen, but I just want to say, just put in my two cents. For us, there's we don't see color. We don't see creed. We don't see religion. We see people. We see the need. That is what we see. And that is what we work with. These are people with different difficulties and problems that they were faced with. And we became sort of one because our fight was the same. So we became one. When we came together and lived in Sasikul House, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy at all. It came with all sorts of challenges. We had people who moved in there, who vandalized the place on a daily basis, making it difficult for us to manage it in a proper and decent and dignified way. There are these elements that just make things difficult for us. That is but one of the challenges. There were many others. When people died, for instance, with no families, we had to take charge and see that that individual is buried in a dignified manner and not just discarded, you know, because this is a destitute case. We became a family. We became one. And that is how we still stand today. I'm going to give over to Karen now so that she can talk about the emotional aspects. With both of us, we have also faced personal, very sad situations on a personal level as well. But through it all, we just had to just go on and do what we were mandated to do, which is help our fellow people, our community. We created a community when we moved into that space there it is.
Yeah. So just echoing some more of the emotions and the sentiment that was brought through by Fahmida. You know, the occupation consists of mainly women, single women-led households. Mm. And being one of those single women-led households, it really wasn't easy to navigate our way through this process of occupying. But through it all, and I think this is where we reach the point that we say, enough is enough, because there was that point in time that we then saw the occupation as the only housing opportunity. Mm. As a movement fighting for people's dignity, not our own dignity only. We were fighting for people's dignity. As women, we have pushed through these 7 years and built a community. And right now, we are even imagining and dreaming about what the future of this space or this community holds for each and every person who lives there. And so, yes, it is emotional because it's our lived experience. It's our lived experience as women. We live in a democratic country, in a democratic dispensation where women's rights should be equal to everyone else's rights. But yet, when you look at the amount of people that are homeless, when you look at the amount of people who are destitute, it would be women and their families. When you look at the amount of people occupying and fighting for their dignity, it is women who are at the forefront of fighting for people's dignity. Yet, we still have a state that fails and does not recognize the rights of women. And hence, I think going to go and do activism in health equity and people's social well-being and fighting for our dignity has been so important for myself personally because of this lived experience. And it's things that we face on a daily basis. So it's not the two of us sitting here telling some fairy tale or some story. We will not even try and romanticize what occupations are about. But this is the hard labor, the labor of women and men fighting for dignity, fighting to have a roof over their families' heads. It is a hard labor that went into this occupation. And it is prone to make us emotional. It is prone that we would take it personal. Because to us, we say that where people live matters. Where we live matters. We want to be close to the social opportunities and amenities and the economic opportunities of our city. We have the right to that. We are citizens of Cape Town, and we do have the right to our dignity. We do have the right to be close to economic and social opportunities. I mean, when I'm thinking back to COVID-19 and how we had to navigate our way through COVID, living in a building that's occupied with more than 1,000 people and people living so close to one another, we learned quite a lot during COVID. We learned from our experiences. And the one thing that really still today stands out for me was, and it's a lesson that we learned during COVID. And as a woman, I took this lesson very seriously, and I do apply it to how I lead in the occupation itself and how I lead in the movement. And that is that when COVID-19 started globally, the UN rapporteur for housing distinctly made a statement to say that the right to access housing or adequate housing, if people do not have that right during a pandemic, you are just as good as being dead and buried. And it is at that juncture that we also then saw really the strong need to have a home, the strong need to have a roof over our heads and to fight and defend this roof over our heads. And so we do so also by resisting any form of
eviction
or displacement. Mm. And we also support tenants who don't live in the occupation, tenants who live in the communities, the surrounding communities, and in the inner city. We support them when they are going through an eviction or when they are being displaced. And the kind of support that we render to them is to have what we call people's assemblies or advice assemblies, where we get together with tenants and occupiers, and together we actually teach one another what the law says about evictions, and we also teach one another our rights. So it's an each one teach one process. And we see there also how people's power is more important than those people who are in power. And we also go and we monitor the courts. We monitor how the courts actually allow for evictions. But we also know that in our constitution, it's stated that magistrates or judges do have an inquisitorial duty toward tenants or towards evictees. And so that inquisitorial duty is to make sure that the person is provided with alternative accommodation. Where this alternative accommodation should be is another story. And so there, that is the unjust part of things. But we have the right to hold judges to account, or the judicial system to account, for rendering people homeless according to our constitution. No one should be rendered homeless. And so those are some of the activities or campaigns that we have also embarked on from the very beginning of our movement, was to say that we are a movement fighting for affordable housing in well-located areas, close to economic and social opportunities, and resisting unjust evictions and displacement. And so those would be the two values that makes up our movement, Reclaim the City. And Reclaim the City are the movement who has gone and occupied abandoned state buildings. So there's more than one Reclaim the City occupation. There is the City Ghoul House, which is the space that we live in. But then there's also the Ahmed Kathrada House on the waterfront on prime property, which was an old nurse's home that also has been occupied by Reclaim the City. And that is what makes up this movement of the landless and of the homeless resisting being pushed out of our city.
Thank you.
And when it comes to City Ghoul House, I'm just finishing quick on that on this point. because my emotions really get triggered when we speak about what does it mean for us. So what does it mean for Karen, for example, after almost 7 years living in an occupation, leading in an occupation, leading in a movement, fighting for housing, or fighting to have roof over one's head, fighting for our dignity, fighting for our citizenship. Because as citizens, we do have the right to engage and to be engaged with, and as communities. And so what does it mean for Karen? What it means for me is that there is this building, this specific building that we have occupied, has now become our home, and that we will defend the space, and we will also push and campaign for affordable housing on the space and in the space. And we do so with our internal structures. As Fahmida had already pointed out, we do have internal structures. And on many of these internal structures, it is led by us as women. And we pursue it. But we don't only just pursue what we are doing. We are also building a movement. We are building a movement of women. We are building a movement of young people. And we are also building people's hope. We are building the hope of those who have been failed and those who have been let down by the state, and that is our elderly people, who many die waiting for housing. Many have died waiting for housing.
Mm.
And it cannot be that way. And one thing that we always do say in ending is, we cannot live in a housing waiting list or database. We need to live in homes because we need to live. And so everything about living in a space matters to us, but where that space is particularly does matter to us. And who we are also matters.
Nothing about us without us. That is what we always say. For me, personally, and on the political side, you know, days when we moved into this space, we were labeled so many things. We were labeled hapless criminals. We were labeled drug peddlers. We were labeled alcohol sellers. We were labeled, you name it, we were labeled all of that. Yet we want to get away from this narrative. But the government is not giving, they're not changing their minds about that. Because we have even invited them on several occasions to come and see how we live in that space that we created into our homes. But they don't want to, they're not interested because they don't want to see a success story. They don't want to see that. They want to see destruction. That is what they want to see. So for me, political is really personal. And where people live should matter. And I'm going to end off with that.
Thank you, Karen and Fahmida, for everything that you have shared throughout this episode. I would like to ask one or two more questions to leave us off. Throughout this episode, you've described what we call like non-growing knowing, you know, living in this uncertainty and still pushing forward with your people. As I sit here in New York City, we have a housing crisis. We have what we're calling a migrant crisis. The more and more people I speak to in the States and Europe and different places all over the world, there's this term, the housing crisis, the housing crisis. We see buildings being built every day, but somehow no one has anywhere to live. What is a message of that you could give to other people around the world that are also fighting, that are also, because, you know, you two have shown so much resilience, so much urgency, fighting through this major struggle of both mental and physical. What is some encouraging messages that you could give to other revolutionaries around the world that may want to work in this field of land, housing, and health equity, or maybe other injustices that they're dealing with?
I think maybe I can go first on this one.
Don't give up. Don't give up. I want to say that first and foremost. You know, with this housing struggle, you know, this it really gets to a point where I'm asking, why should we fight for something that is supposed to be constitutionally due to us? Number one, our parents and grandparents has been fighting the same struggle. Why do we need to fight for something that is so relatively important for you as a person? Why do we still, our fight is like a river. It's a never-ending fight. Our parents has fought. We are fighting now. Will our children also fight for something as simple as a roof over our heads? And we are not asking here for mansions. We're not asking for palaces. We are simply asking for a place to call home. Simple. Why do we have to fight? But I want to encourage others. The fight is far from over. But I want to say is, don't give up. I know people out there has long gone given up hope of being put into a space where they can call home. We felt sort of like that at some point too, even with our court case. We felt like that when we lost our court case. But all is not lost. That is what I want to say. All is not lost. Even though it may seem that there's no light at the end of the tunnel, some light is going to shine up there. So don't give up hope and don't give up fighting for what is constitutionally your right.
Yeah, I mean, despite, so this is a global thing, right?
Absolutely.
And then despite ours and many other activists, movements and communities, and even individual struggles to have a home. It's about having a home. So despite all of that, despite our efforts, right, the states have not been actors in trying to assist and support communities. That is the common picture that I grasp from all of this. And so my question in ending, and my statement in ending here, to encourage others who are facing the same battle, it's a battle and it's a struggle for dignity, is that who then are we waiting for? And the answer to that is very simple. Since there are no state actors supporting us, I would say to everyone out there who feels that as if they cannot move forward with their struggle, I want to say that the struggle continues and we are the ones that we have been waiting for. We are the solution and not the problem. We are the ones that we have been waiting for. A luta continua. The struggle continues. Don't give up.
Absolutely. And if people would like to learn more about you two, learn more about your work, learn more about the political movements and community movements in South Africa that are fighting against land, housing, and health equity, where could people go to find out a little bit more about you two and more about Sissy Gool House?
So they could go on to Reclaim the City's website, which is reclaimthecity.co.za, or alternatively, they could email reclaimthecity@reclaimthecity.01.org.za.
Yes, yes. And we're going to have And we're going to have that in the description section for you, for anyone that would like to stay in contact and learn about the amazing work going on in Cape Town, South